all rise. OE, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeal, draw nigh and give your attention, for this Honorable Court is now in session. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
This is the case of Robert E. Loans versus the Secretary. Mr. Loans is represented by Mr. Landon Overby and the Secretary by Mr. David Quinn. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Overby, do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Landon Overby for the Disabled American Veterans, representing the appellant Robert Loans. Joining me at counsel's table is Ronald Smith, also the Disabled American Veterans. May it please the court. The court should find that Mr. Loans is entitled to an award of reasonable fees and expenses under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Briefly, the Board of Veterans Appeals, in a decision dated January 21, 2003, denied Mr. Loans separate 10% ratings for tinnitus in each of his ears. The Board explained in its decision, among other things, that the provisions of 38 CFR 4.25 were inapplicable to the facts of the case. Mr. Loans timely appealed the Board's decision to this court. And during the appeal to the court, Mr. Loans filed an opening brief in which he argued that the Board incorrectly rejected his argument that 4.25 entitled him to two separate 10% ratings for tinnitus if the condition was bilateral. Mr. Loans further argued that he is entitled to have the tinnitus rated separately in accordance with 4.25. In response to Mr. Loan's opening brief, the Secretary filed a brief in response and argued, for example, that 38 CFR 4.25B was not applicable to the veteran's case. The Secretary further argued that the rating schedule does not provide for separate ratings of each year. The court decided Mr. Loan's appeal in a single-judge order dated April 19, 2005. The court reversed the board's January 2003 decision that interpreted the pre-June 13, 2003 version of Diagnostic Code 6260 as allowing for only a single 10% rating for bilateral tinnitus and remanded the matter for re-adjudication. On July 19, 2005, Mr. Loans made application to this court for an award of reasonable fees and expenses under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Mr. Loans asserted, among other things, that he was a prevailing party and also that the government's position was not substantially justified at either the administrative level or the litigation stage, and therefore that he should be awarded an award of reasonable fees and expenses pursuant to the Equal Access to Justice Act. Mr. Loan submits that he has carried the burden of establishing that he is a prevailing party, a fact which the Secretary has not contested in this matter. And secondly, he submits further that the Secretary has not carried his burden of demonstrating that the government's position was substantially justified at either the administrative or the litigation stages of this case, and therefore that Mr. Loan should be awarded an award of reasonable fees and expenses pursuant to the Equal Access to Justice Act.
Why do you say the Secretary is not substantially justified?
Your Honor, the Secretary, at least at the administrative level, the Board of Veterans Appeals failed to follow the plain language of the law, and that was 4.25B. Even more specifically, the Board found it wasn't even applicable, so it couldn't have even followed the regulation.
But the Board made this decision even before Wanner, did it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Board made its decision before Wanner was even decided.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And when Wanner was decided, did Wanner say that 4.25 applied?
Wanner said that 4.25B was a potentially applicable regulation, yes, okay. Your Honor. And prior to that, this court...
Yes, that it applied, or yes, that it was potentially...
They said it was potentially applicable.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And long before Wanner was decided, this court has held that the board was required to consider all potentially applicable regulations. And this court in Esteban held that 4.25B, that whenever you have a single disease entity and you had multiple disability residuals arising from that single disease entity, that the veteran would be entitled to separate ratings. The board did not follow this court's case law in that regard. The board chose, in a merely happenstance, to say that the board also finds that 4.25 is not applicable, despite the language of the regulation, which was plain, and this court's decision in Smith recognized that, as well as Still Laws.
Did they give any reason for it not being applicable?
No, Your Honor. There's no explanation beyond, again, the last sentence, I believe, on page 7 of the record, in which the board just notes that the board would also find that 4.25 is not applicable. Despite the arguments by Mr. Lund's representatives at the Board of Veterans' Appeals that 4.25, as well as Esteban, as well as this court's decision in Coleon, required separate ratings whenever there was multiple disability residuals arising from a single disease entity. And I would point out that with respect to the Secretary's argument that the General Counsel opinion was explicitly relied on by the Board, I must point out that the General Counsel opinion was not issued until 5 months after the Board's decision. As well as, although the Secretary has argued that 4.25 was cited several times, as we've just discussed, the Board found at the last minute that it was not even applicable, which was contrary to the plain language of the regulation as well as this Court's case law. And Mr. Lones would submit that the Secretary has not carried the burden of demonstrating that his position at the administrative level or the litigation stage, with only Mr. Lones having to satisfy the fact that the Board's position or the Secretary's position at the litigation stage was not substantially justified, Mr. Lones is entitled to an award of EJIA fees and expenses.
Does the Secretary need to demonstrate that the entire Secretariat with regard to the processing of this case was substantially justified, or only that the RO and the Board and its litigation posture were substantially justified? Otherwise stated, does the General Counsel's opinion itself come into consideration?
No, Your Honor. Not in this particular case.
Not in this case.
But as to your question, yes, the Secretary would have to demonstrate that the position at both the administrative level, which would encompass the RO and the Board, as well as the litigation stage, would have to be substantially justified. Otherwise, Mr. Lones is entitled to an award of reasonable fees and expenses. There are no further questions.
Are you familiar with case of White v. Nicholson?
I am, Your Honor.
And in that case, the Federal Circuit said that Pierce said that in order for the government to be deemed unjustified, it is not enough for a reg to be deemed facially invalid. Something else must be present. So if the diagnostic code for tinnitus was facially invalid, is that sufficient enough here to say that the government was not substantially justified?
I would say that would be one factor to look at, Your Honor, because under this court's decision in Stillwell, it's the totality of the circumstances. I think White's distinguishable because we don't have a regulation, or regulations, I should say, 4.25, as well as the diagnostic code, that have been held to be facially invalid. The court in Smith looked at the plain language of the regulations and held that the plain language entitled a veteran, including Mr. Lones, to separate 10% ratings as a matter of law. And in White,
so you're saying then that the 10% that was relating to tinnitus in the diagnostic code was really for 10% for each year?
Based on I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Even though that it didn't really say that in the diagnostic code, what you're saying is that diagnostic code is not facially invalid.
It's not facially invalid. There were no exceptions, as this court noted in Smith. There was no exceptions as required by 4.25, where it says unless there are other exceptions, then a single disease entity would be rated separately for all disability residuals arising from that entity. And there's nothing facially invalid about the plain language of both the diagnostic code as well as 4.25. Again, White is distinguishable because White was based on the Federal Circuit's overruling of 19.9, which I believe the Secretary had a reasonable basis to conclude in that particular case that they could create a regulation and they thought they were following their statutory command. And here we have the plain language of the regulations. There's nothing facially invalid about those regulations. And I would say that this case falls right on point with this court's decision, Swiney v. v. Gober, in which the court found that where the secretary's interpretation is contrary to the plain language of the regulation, then the secretary's position cannot be substantially justified. And it's very similar to this case. I believe that the secretary has not carried the burden and that the Board of Veterans' Appeals failed to follow the plain language of the regulations and resulted
in... What's the site on that case?
I'm sorry?
What's the site on that case?
It's 14 Bed App, in particular, 14 Bed App 65,
Thank
with
you.
A pinpoint site to 7172.
Thank you. Is there a difference between a process where the secretary goes through and analyzes the various regulations, gives an explanation why regulations that appear on their face to apply may not apply, and a situation where there's a mere rejection of a regulation as inapplicable to the facts in the case without explanation? Does that come into consideration with substantial justification?
I believe it would, but the board... following this court's case law, which has been around for many years, that the board would have to at least provide an explanation as to why it wouldn't find particular regulation inapplicable or why it wouldn't find it applicable. The board provided no explanation here. There would be situations such as a veteran who is claiming entitlement to non-service-connected pension, and under this court's decision under Sabonis, the veteran had only peace on service, the veteran would not be entitled to consideration for pension, and the board wouldn't be obligated to consider those regulations based on the situation of the case. But that's not the situation here. We had case law in the form of Esteban as well as Colleong, and the secretary's rating schedule had tinnitus under as a disease of the year, and that whenever it manifested into disability involving both ears, that under 4.25, Mr. Loans and any other veteran would be entitled to separate 10% ratings following the plain language of the regulations.
The 4.25 was actually argued before the board?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. I believe it was argued on three different occasions by both the regional office representative as well as the representative before the Board of Veterans' Appeals, as well as the court's decision at Esteban and Colleon.
Had there ever been a decision of this court that interpreted 4.25 vis-a-vis the portion of the rating schedule 62-60?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
So this is a case of first impression?
This particular case, well, Smith was the more...
But it would have been a case of first impression for the board, right?
I'm not sure if it was a case of first impression. They'd considered the matters before. But when it was decided by this court, yes, it was a case of first impression.
And when you say they decided the matters before, had they decided the matters consistently before, the same way that they have now? Did in this case?
I believe in some cases they had decided that a veteran wasn't entitled to separate 10% ratings. Some cases there would be consideration of 4.25B, whereas in this particular case there was not.
When they in all of those cases, was the result the same?
Yes, it was, I believe, Your Honor. But even if this was a case of first impression, again, I must point out that the court's decision in Swiney v. Gober looked at the exact same situation in dealing with the court's decision in Meekin and found that where the board operates or the secretary's interpretation operates contrary to the plain language of the regulations, then the secretary's position was not substantially justified. And we would submit that the secretary has not carried that burden here.
When an issue is specifically raised by a claimant before the board, such as you indicated was raised here, 4.25, isn't there an obligation on the board to address the argument that's presented to them?
I believe so, Your Honor. And the board, again, just explained, and again, it was more or less happenstance. It wasn't any explanation as to why 4.25 was inapplicable. Just the board would also point out, and I believe that the board had an obligation, especially since it was argued. There are no further questions?
Do you know for a fact whether or not it was argued in other cases? 4.25 before the board?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I can't necessarily direct you to all those cases, but when I worked at the Board of Veterans Appeals for DAV, I made that argument on numerous occasions.
Thank you.
Is it your argument, then, that the Secretary's position is not substantially justified because they didn't articulate some sort of a reason for their reliance on 4.25?
Your Honor, I believe it's not only that, but more importantly, that the Board failed to follow the plain language of the regulations. Again, where the Board fails to follow the plain language of the regulations, the Secretary's position can't be substantially justified.
Well, I guess it's a little bit reversed here because the Secretary has the burden, so I guess we'll hear what the Secretary has to say.
Certainly.
But you'll have a chance in rebuttal. Perhaps I can follow up then.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, David Quinn on behalf of the Secretary, with Richard Merrick at Council table with me today. The Court in this case should deny Mr. Lund's EJ application because the Secretary was substantially justified at both the administrative stages and at the litigation stages. The test that the Court uses in determining whether or not the Secretary was substantially justified begins with using a reasonable person and looking at the totality of the circumstances in the case at hand, including the merits determination, the conduct of the agency, the reasons given for the decision that was issued, the consistency with judicial precedent, consistency with VA's policy on the issue, and the state of the law. And when you look at the state of the law, you look at whether it's an issue that's evolving in the area of VA benefits law, you look at whether it's an issue of first impression, and you look at whether or not the Secretary advanced a good faith argument, even if it's ultimately concluded to be an incorrect argument, on that particular issue. And the Secretary submits that in this case, most of those factors weigh in his favor for finding that he was substantially justified at both the board level and at the litigation stage.
Which ones don't weigh in his favor?
In all honesty, Your Honor, I would say none of them don't weigh in our favor. There are some that, you know, it could be on the fence. But
which ones are on the fence?
I would say the ones that were on the fence would be probably the merits determination in retrospect, in light of the ultimate decisions that were issued. But it's one of many factors that goes in. At the time the decision was rendered by the board, the merits determination could have been found by a reasonable person to have been correct based upon all the other factors of the totality of the circumstances.
And explain to me what you mean by merits determination.
The outcome that the board reached on the issue of entitlement to a award of bilateral service connection for bilateral.
So just
case.
The outcome might have.
Correct, Your Honor. Just the outcome of the case.
Is there anything else that you see?
No, Your Honor. I would submit that the rest of the
factors. What about the failure to discuss 4.25 to definitively state it's inapplicable to the facts in this case?
I would
when
say
4.25 specifically says, except as otherwise noted, it is applicable.
I would say that there wasn't a failure to discuss 4.25, Your Honor. The board did, in fact, consider and discuss it to the extent that they found the regulation to not be applicable.
And do you think there's a satisfactory reasons and basis?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
So a definitive statement that it is not applicable to the facts of this case is all that is necessary. No discussion as to why it is not applicable?
Well, I think you need to back up a little bit and look at the language that leads into that determination. The board's looking at a diagnostic code that doesn't on its face provide for a bilateral award. They're looking at a 50-year practice by the agency which didn't recognize entitlement to such an award. There's a case in Cromley that the board uses and looks at and tries to harmonize with what the practice of the agency had been as suggestive that such an award was not
accepting
possible.
Accepting all of that, didn't the appellant specifically argue that 4.25 was applicable?
He did, Your Honor. But the
and the only answer is it's not applicable.
And it's not applicable because based on all the other things the board had walked through, it found that Cromley and the diagnostic code, the regulation in particular, didn't permit for such an award, the 4.25 necessarily had to not be applicable, because to make it applicable would have resulted in the very thing he was seeking, which the board didn't believe was possible.
But 4.25 specifically states, except as otherwise provided in the schedule.
Correct, Your Honor, and that does stem, as I understand what your line of questioning is, it does stem from the analysis that came out of Smith. But at the time the board was rendering the decision,
Well, what was the argument presented by the claimant?
That he was entitled under 4.25.
Okay.
But at that time... That
and the answer is it's not applicable.
Correct, Your Honor. At the time, the board was looking at it. A reasonable person looking at everything else, even though the appellant might have advanced an argument that a certain regulation or statute might have been applicable, doesn't make it so. There was no judicial, there was no adverse judicial precedent saying that the application of 4.25 was appropriate. In fact, if you look at Cromley, Cromley suggested that 4.25 wasn't applicable because it specifically held that 10% was the max that an individual could get for an award of bilateral or for an award of tinnitus, bilateral or otherwise. And the board, using that in the diagnostic code, reached the conclusion that necessarily 4.25 could not have been applicable. A reasonable person looking at all of those different circumstances could have found that the secretary's position at the board level to be substantially justified. It's not so much an issue of whether or not the board decision ultimately is correct or incorrect. It's a question. The test is whether or not a reasonable person could have found the position in law and fact to have been correct. And that's what the secretary submits as the case here, that a reasonable person.
I think you accurately stated that for us to make our determination, this reasonable person standard, there's not one factor that weighs over others, but we have to balance all of them. So it would be helpful to me, at least, if you could run down the factors that you think are important to support your position and why the facts, in your view, support it.
Of course, Your Honor. If you start with the conduct and the reasons given for the decision as a starting point, up until case in Warner, there hadn't been any judicial precedent or any suggestion by the agency or anybody else for that matter that would have been binding upon the board that there was a possibility of an award of bilateral service connection for the disease tinnitus. Those came after the board's decision here, so there's a vacuum that the board is operating in from an adverse perspective of law. They then look to the diagnostic code. The diagnostic code on its face doesn't provide for an award of bilateral tinnitus. It simply says 10%. They then look to the court and found Cromley that specifically said 10% is the most you can get for tinnitus. And if you were to grant a bilateral award for the disease entity tinnitus, you would necessarily be giving a 20% rating for the award because although bilateral, it's still one disease, and the combination under 4.25 of two 10% would have resulted in a 19% under 4.25 that would have been rounded to 20%. So the board, in looking at those factors, and the issue of first impression, really, came to the conclusion that an award of bilateral service connection was not possible.
Was Cromley bilateral?
Well, the issue was increased rating, Your Honor, and there was evidence in the record that his condition was bilateral in nature.
Well, the hearing loss was found to be bilateral in Cromley, not the tinnitus.
The bilateral hearing loss was service-connected. Tinnitus was service-connected as a single entity, but there was medical evidence that Mr. Cromley actually had bilateral tinnitus.
But I think the portion of the opinion doesn't, well, it might hint at what you're saying. I'm not sure that it's that definitive, but that'll be something for us to consider. I understand your position.
But a reasonable person, Your Honor, looking at how Cromley had set it forth, or set it up, and looking at all these other circumstances, could have believed that the Secretary's position that a single award of service connection for tinnitus would have been a right decision, even though it's ultimately invalidated by the court through Smith and Starlaws and Anderson. At the time, we submit that a reasonable person looking at those factors.
You're talking about those factors. The factors that I have written down here, you discussed basically the state of the law at the time was undeveloped in this area, and this was an area of first impression. Now, when you first started your argument, you listed probably six or seven factors. So you have anything else on any of the other factors, or did you want to further develop this factor?
Well, I would say that you're correct, Your Honor, in looking at the state of the law. It's an evolving thing. That's one of the factors that is in the Secretary's favor here. You have to look at whether or not that the board made a good faith argument here or decision here, I guess, for lack of a better term. That would go into the Secretary's favor. The consistency with judicial precedent, as best as the board could tell, it was following what it thought to be the law in Cromley and the application of the diagnostic code. So that would be in the agency's favor as well. Consistency of VA policy, the Federal Register that came out shortly before the board's decision, noted that this was a longstanding practice. And so it was consistent with the agency's history and practice of how we treated tinnitus. So that would be in the Secretary's favor. The reasons given, although they probably could have been a little bit more thorough and flushed out a little bit better, I think a reasonable reading of how the board laid it out when they walked through the diagnostic code and then cite to Cromley, and then right after that cite to Cromley's discussion of 4.25.
Why wouldn't a more thorough discussion of 4.25 by the board have led to the opposite conclusion?
Why would it not have, Your Honor?
You're suggesting that a more thorough discussion might have been required or better, but it would have led to the same result. And I'm suggesting to you, if they had discussed 4.25 and done the analysis of 4.25 and its interplay, what makes you think they wouldn't have come out with a different position?
Well, it would have been inconsistent with the...
Did they cite the Federal Register?
They did not cite the Federal Register, Your Honor, but it would be inconsistent with the practice of the agency for the previous 50 years.
Had the agency in the previous 50 years ever considered 4.25 and its interplay with the rating schedule?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, no. But
then if they had done the analysis, how do you know what the result would have been?
Because as I read the board's decision, they were relying upon Cromley in the absence of anything in the diagnostic code to have afforded them relief under 4.25. They took the diagnostic code and Cromley, put them together and said the best you can do is a 10% rating. 4.25, even if they discussed it, wouldn't have resulted in a change because it would have, in effect, superseded the court's decision as the board understood it in Cromley, which is not possible. So the outcome would have been the same. You just would have had
You're assuming the outcome would have been the same. There's no discussion such as you just gave to us.
You're correct, Your Honor. But again, it goes back to what a reasonable person looking at it would have thought.
Wouldn't a reasonable person looking at it have done an analysis of the interfacing regulations, particularly when it was presented by the claimant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed part of that. Could you?
Wouldn't
that?
A reasonable person being addressed by a claimant who is seeking disability benefits, stating that 4.25 applies, etc., have addressed whether or not 4.25 did indeed apply, and had addressed whether or not Cromley had bilateral tinnitus, and addressed whether or not the Federal Circuit, the Federal Register that you cite had come out before this, which is not mentioned here. Wouldn't they have done an analysis across the board on that? Wouldn't a reasonable person have done that?
It's not a question of whether a reasonable person would have done the analysis, Your Honor. It's a question of what the board did and what a reasonable person views the board having done. And R&B errors generally are not held to, they don't necessarily equate to an unreasonable position by the agency. The question keeps coming back to what did the board do, and could a reasonable person looking at what the board did have thought the board's decision, the board's outcome, to have been reasonable? Not whether the board was ultimately right or wrong, or whether or not the court ultimately invalidates the approach that we took. It's just whether looking at what the board was viewing and the outcome the board reached, could they have reached that outcome? And we submit the answer to that yes.
Do you have any additional factors I'd like to carry?
What importance, if any, should we place upon the degree of specificity with which the board justified its decision in this case?
It is a factor amongst many that the court needs to consider. The ultimate question, and I'm sorry if I sound like I'm beating a dead horse here, but you got to keep coming back to whether or not that reasonable person standing there looking at the ultimate conclusion the board reached.
No, I understand that.
And the manner in which the board went through the analysis could have been correct. It is one factor. There are many things.
Well, that's the ultimate decision we have to reach. And it seems to me that in reaching that decision, we weigh many individual factors, which you so eloquently articulated at the beginning of your argument. And the factors don't help us if they exist in a vacuum, at least don't help me. I need to attach the facts of this case to the factors and see how they weigh them on each side. So one of the factors, it seems to me, that's being discussed by Judge Castle here that interests me at the moment is what importance should we attach to the degree of thoroughness or specificity that the board discussed this tension between 4.25 and 6260, if any. I mean, is that important or is it not important? In other words, if they would have discussed it, the fact that they discussed it in a somewhat cursory fashion, is that, should we take that into account, or should we take in, or is that important at all for us?
I would say, Your Honor, that there is a minimal amount of weight that should go into the depth of the board's analysis when examining whether or not the ultimate conclusion reached was one that a reasonable person could have reached, based upon factors that not only were outlined, but what the board actually looked at, even in a cursory manner. I think you can look at what the board did without the benefit of the depth that maybe it could have provided, and see exactly where it is they went with this. They looked at the diagnostic code, they walked through the diagnostic code, said we do not see anything in the diagnostic code that permits for it, turned to the court's decision in Cromwell and said, well, that seems to support what the diagnostic code, our impression of the diagnostic code is, which is consistent with our long practice, and come to the conclusion that they came to, 4.25 is not applicable.
But you just added an awful lot of things that are not in this board decision, didn't you? I mean, where's the consistency with past practice, full analysis of bilateral tinnitus and whether or not it's entitled to dual ratings, applicability or non-applicability in discussion thereof with 4.25 other than a definitive statement? Where is all that in this board decision?
It's not all in the board's decision.
All right, so board decisions are not precedential.
Correct.
Only regulations are, or general counsel opinions. And at this particular point, a claimant comes before this board and says, aha, 4.25 is here. It says it applies unless it's specifically accepted. And the board says, not applicable. I mean, you gave a lot of rationale. I'm not disputing that, but where is it in here?
It's not in there, Your Honor.
And, all right. And so how do we know that the board would not have come out with a different conclusion had they done that analysis?
I don't think it's a question of whether the board would or would not have come out to a different conclusion.
Well, it is it isn't?
Well, in the extent that, to the extent that we're looking at the EJA here, and we're not looking at the merits determination.
How can you be substantially justified in taking a position if you don't do the analysis that's required to come up with a conclusion that your position is validated when a specific argument is presented to you?
The position that the board took has to be viewed in totality, not just the actual merits determination that the board rendered. You have to look at everything that was out there at the time that supported the board's position. To look at just the board's analysis itself would be akin to relitigating the issue here at the EJA stage, which the court should not be doing, as it has noted numerous times. You look at everything that was out there and existing, and whether or not the board, in reaching the outcome it could have, that the board that it did reach, could have reached that outcome. The totality of the circumstances, not just the merits of the board's decision.
And I don't mean to totally beat a dead horse, but I'm having a hard time understanding. If an issue is presented to you and you come back and definitively reject it without an analysis, without a discussion, without an interplay, how can you address whether or not that was decision made in good faith? How can you address whether or not it was consistent with precedent? How can you address whether or not it was consistent with VA policy? It's not in this board decision. How can you put those thoughts within the head of the board?
Well,
it's not there. It's not presented in their decision, so...
You're correct, Your Honor. To the extent that you're looking at the board's decision for the merits, you're absolutely correct. The problem is you've got to take a step back from the board's decision, and you've got to look at the entire picture here. The board may not have put forth an analysis that was as encompassing as it maybe should have been, but that's not where we stop for our analysis here at the EJA stage. We need to take a step back and look at could a reasonable person looking at everything in total? I mean, you start with Stillwell and you work up through Fountain and Ozark.
No, I understand what you're saying, but if the board had addressed the issue presented to it, I'm having a hard time why you're jumping to a conclusion that it wouldn't have come out with a different result. Certainly this court came out with a different result. And if they had addressed that issue that had been presented to it, we may not have had any litigation. They may have been awarded. We don't know that.
But that gets us back into relitigating the merits of the
case. I don't want to relitigate it. I'm just looking at the board decision and trying to go down your criteria.
Correct, but you can't do it just from that isolated document. You have to step back and look at everything in total. Let's assume for the sake of argument that there was a case specifically on point that the board didn't address that specifically prohibited an award of bilateral tinnitus. The fact that the board didn't discuss it but came to the conclusion that it was not permissible would not have rendered the board's decision unreasonable, which is the standard that you're looking at here. The board's decision would have been deficient, absolutely. But the question in the grand scheme of things of reasonableness would have weighed in the Secretary's favor because there would have been a case that specifically required that outcome. And I submit that if you look at the Federal Register, you look at the long practice, you look at the case in Cromwell, you look at the diagnostic code, all of these things are stacking up outside the vacuum of that board's decision that a reasonable person would have to take into account.
But wouldn't the end result of that be that any new argument presented to the board could be rejected out of hand?
No, Your Honor. It wouldn't. I mean...
Well, because you could look outside the board decision at all the other criteria that have been established, and the answer could be to a claimant, well, it's inapplicable because we've never done it that way. Isn't that what you're arguing?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I think, as I understand the question, we might be looking at this at two different stages here. Your argument seems to suggest that you're looking at it in a merits determination and not in an EJIA context.
No, I'm trying to put your argument in place of the criteria you gave, that's all. And what's coming across to me, and you can explain it, what's coming across to me is you can make any new argument you want at the board. It can be rejected out of hand and not discussed, and it doesn't matter because when you look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding, the agency would have rejected it in any event, or perhaps, I mean, I'm not sure if you take the other side of that, that they might have accepted it. And it seems to me that in a litigated stage, including this board in the adjudicative stage, an issue was presented, and that issue, you have to admit, is pretty soundly rejected without analysis. It's inapplicable to the facts in this case without a discussion as to why it's inapplicable. And so the question becomes, if you present a new issue to the agency and the agency rejects it out of hand, is that okay because no court had yet decided the issue? That's what I'm grappling with.
I would say no, Your Honor. If there was VA policy that was to the contrary, if there was a bad faith argument, if you will, in the presentation of that, I mean, the
but is there VA policy cited in this board decision?
It's not cited in the board decision, Your Honor, but again, you don't look just to the four corners of this board's decision to determine whether or not the agency was substantially justified in the position that it ultimately reached. And I would submit that the board didn't reject 4.25 just out of hand. They walked through an analysis and found that based upon 6260 and citing to the case in Cromley, 4.25 could not have been applicable because Cromley says the most you can get is a 10% evaluation. Looking at the Secretary's position at the litigation stage, Secretary would submit that he, again, was reasonable and substantially justified in advocating the position that was taken. It was really nothing more than an offshoot of the board's decision. At the time, Smith had not yet issued. There was, of course, the general counsel's opinion that came out after Mr. Lone's BVA decision came out that adds to the number of factors that the court should be looking to in order to determine reasonableness in this case.
And looking to that GC opinion with regard to the legislative stage, does the general counsel address 4.25?
In the opinion, he does not, Your Honor.
Had not this court issued an opinion already 6 months prior saying that 4.25 was something that should be considered?
I believe in Warner, Your Honor, the court said it was potentially applicable and sent it back for the board to discuss.
Correct. And the general counsel didn't cite Warner, does it not? In the general counsel opinion?
I believe he does, Your Honor.
Does not discuss 4.25?
It does not discuss 4.25, Your Honor. That is correct.
But again, so what evidence do you have that the agency gave any serious consideration to 4.25?
The question of whether or not the agency gave serious consideration or slight consideration or
any consideration.
No consideration, I don't think is a factor that's one that should be weighed heavily here for the court in this particular case in the context of whether or not the agency was substantially justified in reaching the decision that it reached. If you look at how we got to where we were at the time that we submitted the brief in Galone's case to the court, there was WANR out there that suggested a potential applicability. And, of course, the court did invalidate the GC opinion in Smith to the extent that it didn't address 4.25. But I think my point was merely that it was one more factor that was worth considering in the totality of the circumstances. Looking at everything in general, the GC opinion is really nothing more than an elaboration of where we had started from with regard to our position on 4.25. The fact that the GC opinion didn't discuss it, it was addressed in Smith and thus found it invalid. But it's one more thing that the court's forced to look at in the totality of the circumstances.
So do you see, if the board had discussed in more detail 4.25 and why they found it inapplicable, and if the GC opinion had discussed 4.25 and found why it was inapplicable, and did an analysis and demonstrated that the secretary had given serious consideration to its regulations, do you see a difference between that scenario and the scenario that seems to be presented here?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that the board didn't give a serious consideration of 4.25. They addressed the issue and found it to not be applicable. I don't see a different outcome in the case. I believe the board would have looked at the same factors that it looked at, and the longstanding practice and policy of the agency when it did a more thorough discussion of the Federal Register and the 4.25 regulation, and come up to the same conclusion. And I think a reasonable person looking at it, although the position was ultimately found to not be correct, a reasonable person looking at it could have found it to be correct. There's a nice line in the court's decision in Ozer where Judge Holder talks about reasonable minds being able to come up with different positions and different findings on a particular position. And if a reasonable mind can come up to a certain conclusion, which the Secretary submits in this case is the case, then the position would be necessarily substantially justified. And in this case, notwithstanding the court's decision in Smith and Stolas Anderson, the Secretary has taken a position as to the applicability both at the agency level and the court level here. The Department of Justice, and taking the appeal to the Federal Circuit, has at least in part agreed with the position. The Solicitor General of the United States, in signing off personally on the appeal to the Federal Circuit, has taken a position. And I think what we have here is a situation where we have a number of different reasonable minds coming up with different conclusions.
Well, isn't that why it's not that the outcome is determinative, but whether or not the agency was substantially justified? And I go back to my question, how can you be substantially justified if you don't even give serious consideration to an argument that is presented?
Again, Your Honor, I disagree with you respectfully that it wasn't considered seriously. They simply found it's not applicable.
Mr. Quinn, is it relevant that at the time of the board decision, 6260 was being considered for amendment?
It is relevant, Your Honor, in the totality of the circumstances, absolutely.
And what is that relevance?
A certain weight that should be afforded to the announcement of what the agency's longstanding policy had been with regards to these sort of claims, this type of disability award. The Federal Register, of course, had been out before the decision in this case, and certainly was out in the amendment out at the time that the General Counsel was advancing his position in the briefs before this court. So I think there's a great weight that should be placed upon that as to what, when you're looking at the test, as to what the agency policy had been and whether or not the board or the general counsel's office in advancing positions was contrary to that policy.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Quinn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Overby?
Your Honor, just a few points on rebuttal with respect to the Secretary's argument. With respect to the Secretary's argument that there's been a longstanding policy, and this Court specifically rejected that, and the Secretary actually made that same argument in Smith and even argued that the Secretary's position should be found reasonable and given deference. This Court rejected that argument in Smith. And the Court in Smith found that the plain language of the regulations, 4.25, Diagnostic Code 6260, would permit separate 10% ratings because there was no exception. And under the Supreme Court's precedence in Rivers v. Roadway Express, as well as United States v. Security Industrial Bank, we know that statutes operate prospectively while judicial decisions operate retrospectively. And with respect to the Secretary's argument that Cromley held that a veteran was only entitled to a 10%, we would submit that Cromley stands for the fact that a veteran could get a single 10% for either year, but 4.25 was never at play. The maximum rating that a veteran could get would be 10% for an year. It didn't hold that a veteran would be entitled to a 10% rating for both years. And once again, Cromley never considered 4.25B. We would submit that proper application of the plain language of the regulations, very similar to this Court's decision in Swiney, that the Secretary's position would not be substantially justified where it fails to follow the plain language of the regulations.
Do you believe that the Secretary's position is arguable?
I believe it's not, Your Honor. I believe a reasonable person who fails to follow the plain language of the regulations, if they would follow the plain language, here they didn't even get that close to following the regulations, then the person would be entitled to separate 10% ratings. This Court's case law was before the Board and even argued to the Board permitting separate ratings whenever there was multiple disability residuals arising from a single disease entity. There was no question about Esteban and Colion, but the Board never even addressed those matters, despite the fact that they were argued to them. So I would submit, Your Honor, that the Secretary's position is not arguable. As for the litigation position as well, the Secretary cites to the Federal Register change in 2003. As this Court in Smith once again noted, the Secretary misstated the law in the Federal Register notice. In the Federal Register notice, the Secretary had indicated that a single disease entity would be provided a single disability rating. That's, once again, contrary to the plain language of 4.25, which said a single disease entity will be provided a disability rating for each residual arising from that entity. Here are the cases in the litigation position, which, again, misstates the law. That was rejected by this Court in Smith as plainly erroneous. I would submit that the Secretary has not carried the burden of showing that his position was substantially justified at either the administrative level or the litigation phase, and therefore that Mr. Loans is entitled to an award of reasonable fees and expenses pursuant to the EJA. If there are no other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. The Court will greet the bar and then adjourn.
All rise. Court stand adjourned for 5 minutes.